ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
At a rural picnic spot in the dark, a young man suddenly disappears.
You could nearly say an alien took him away because he's just vanished.
When more clues from that night surface, something doesn't sit right.
It's nonsensical where the stuff is. It's been scattered.
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravelled.
Is it a murder? Is it someone just gone missing?
You know where my son is.
Search for the Unravelled podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Not too long ago, I wrote a column calling for the nationalisation of Australia's childcare industry, and it got a lot of attention. The industry's come under some very public scrutiny in the past couple of years. There's been an investigation of child abuse, investigations into the safety of centres, but despite that, or perhaps alongside it, it's become almost a fact of modern life that every day in this country, many, many families send their kids to care. So I thought it might be a good idea to follow up on the ideas posed in my column with an interview on the podcast with someone who actually knows what they're talking about. Now, I didn't want to interview a CEO in the industry so they could just push their own barrow. So I asked someone who's been studying this industry for years and has written a number of papers and reports on the subject, plus submissions, including lots of recommendations about what should happen to childcare in this country. That person is Adelaida Soltysik, an analyst with the Centre for Policy Development and one of Australia's foremost experts on childcare. Who better to ask? Is the system broken? Does there need to be some reform? And if so, what does that look like? And a reminder, like with all things, there's good and bad in both sides. For example, many listening know that there are some great for-profit centres. But when we dive in, the data tells us a very clear story about the differences between for-profit and not-for-profit care. So in this conversation, we explore what we know, where the industry is right now, and where it could go. G'day, Adelaida Soltysik. Thanks very much for joining That's Business.
Thanks for having me.
Adelaida, there's been a lot of commentary about the childcare industry recently, a lot of it bad. So where do you think the industry sits at the moment? Do you think it's in a bad place?
Yeah, I think it's a fair criticism because we have a lot of public money being spent currently on a system that is still really expensive for families and quality is quite uneven. We've got high quality and high income areas, lower quality and lower income areas. And it is a system that's predominantly driven by for-profit growth. So we've got 70% of the market that's currently for-profit provision. And we know that for-profit provision on average is lower quality than not-for-profit and government provision. At the same time, though, we do still have really amazing high-quality services. A lot of those are not-for-profit community-run services. We've got Aboriginal community-controlled organisations that are run and owned by the community, and there's trust there. And then on top of that, there's incredible work being done by early childhood educators who often go above and beyond in spite of the conditions that they face. So I think it's very fair to criticise the system as a whole, but there's a lot of really great aspects about it. And I think there's a lot that can be done.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that. But can you just take us through the history of the industry and how we got where we are?
Yeah, so Australia's early childhood education care system, like a lot of social services system, has evolved quite a bit over time. It started off as sort of more philanthropic welfare type services. And then in the 60s and 70s, government played more of an active role by directly funding these services. And a lot of those were primarily not-for-profit, community-run. There was a lot of parental involvement.
But they're not. But the government didn't own them. They were just funding them, were they?
They were funding them. They also, some of them were owned by the government, but a lot of them were not-for-profit, direct funding. And a major shift happened in the late 80s and early 90s where two things happened. The first is the funding changed from direct provider provision to one that's more of a consumer-centric type model that follows the user and rather than directly funding the provider.
Why did that happen?
So, that combined with the fact that funding also opened up to for-profit provision was, I guess, under the premise that if you marketize the system, it will increase supply, introduce competition, and put downward pressures on prices and quality.
And who made that decision? Was that a government decision at the time? And which government was it?
It started off with the Fraser, Hawke, Keating governments, went on through John Howard and continued on basically to where we have now. So it was many different iterations of governments. And I guess through that, we saw an acceleration of for-profit provision. That's why we're in the situation where we have now, where every year, 90% of new providers that open are for-profit.
So the industry was never really part of either federal or state governments like education, like primary and secondary education.
Yeah, it was separate to education. And I think the early education and care system has always struggled to distinguish itself as something that's an essential public service. It's been seen as a luxury or an add-on. And a lot of that has to do with assumptions about gender roles and things like that. So it has primarily been seen as something that's separate from education.
What do you mean by assumption about gender roles? Do you mean it's tied in with the way, I don't know, a lot of people see women's role as being at home, looking after kids rather than going to work. Is that
yes,
kind of what
yes.
you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And that's obviously changed. I mean, the participation of women in the workforce has been rising steadily for decades. I mean, and that's happened.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. And I think, and I guess that's why a lot of people would say that the system as designed now is not really fit for purpose, because it's not designed as something that would be a public good. It is designed as something that is an optional add-on, when we know for many families that's not the case.
So describe the structure of the industry now. You said that it's 70% for profit. Is that right? I mean, that means that 30% is private but not for profit. And who owns and runs them, and who owns the 70% that's for profit?
So 70% of the market currently is for-profit, and that's been increasing quite a lot. So 10 years ago, it was 50%. Now it's 70%. That for-profit composition is made up of a range of different providers. It can be small, family-owned. It can be bigger, private equity-backed type services, providers that might run 40 to 50 services. It might be ASX listed. But I guess the thing is about the way that the current subsidy system is designed is that we actually don't know in a lot of detail who's funding the system, who runs the system, where the public money is going, whether it's going to profits or cheaper fees or quality. In terms of the other 30%, that's predominantly run by not-for-profit and government organisations.
And how many government organisations are there? Many at all?
Not a lot of government organisations. So for long daycare, there's about 300 to 350 government organisations delivering that service. Most of it is really not-for-profit run.
Right. But how did the government ones get there? Why did they start?
Some of it is from historical reasons. Some of it may be that government has decided that there's a gap there and that they need to come in. But it's not sort of business as usual for government to be operating these services. It's usually done as a distance through the subsidy system.
Tell us, describe how the subsidies currently work.
Yeah, so the way that it currently works is that it's the family, the parent, that's subsidised, and it's kind of like a voucher system. So they get a subsidy for the fee that's means tested, and then they use that to navigate the market of different providers to decide which provider that they can go to. And that approach has been happening for the last few decades, and it's also resulted in the government kind of stepping back a bit more and letting the market really decide where services open, how much they charge, the kinds of services that they deliver.
And how much of the fee is subsidised? And how does the means test work? Because it's the means test is quite heavy, isn't it?
So the way that the means testing operates is that it's dependent on your income. So it tapers off according to how much that you earn, and it might start at 90% and then tapers down as you start to earn more money.
Right.
And it's difficult for a lot of families, particularly those with fluctuating incomes, so those who might have small businesses or might be casual part-time workers, because you do need to predict your earnings for the next year. And if you overshoot, then you might get a bill at the end of the year.
Yeah, a lot of the criticism I hear, apart from the safety of them, which we'll get into in a moment, but a lot of the criticism is that it's really expensive for people. So obviously for a lot of families, the subsidy falls away too quickly. That, you know, it's still very expensive for people earning, you know, not huge amounts of money.
Yeah, definitely. And I think people often talk about means testing as if it's a more efficient way of administering government resources. But really, I think that often overlooks the fact that when you have really strong universal systems, there's a sense of shared ownership over those systems. There's an incentive to make sure that quality is upheld. It's more likely to last over election cycles. And really, it's the tax system's role to redistribute resources and put money into what we determine public goods. So we don't means test public education. We don't means test public transport or going to the pool. And so it is unusual that for something that is so important as early education and care, that we have this kind of very specific means testing that happens that makes it much more difficult for families to access.
One recent reform to how it works was the three-day guarantee. Could you tell us what that is and why was it introduced?
Yeah, so the three-day guarantee is about a guarantee of 3 days of subsidised care. So before that, in addition to the means testing, there was also a test around the number of hours you had to work. And there's been a lot of advocates, including at CPD, we've talked about how that activity test was quite a massive barrier for a lot of families. So the three-day guarantee is a really important step, taking that barrier away to enable all families, no matter how much they work, to have access to the subsidized care. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's affordable. It's just that they have access to that subsidized care.
A couple of years ago, the Productivity Commission did a big review of the industry, and it recommended that the maximum childcare subsidy should be increased to 100% for some families on incomes up to a certain amount. But that wasn't done by the government. Is it because it would have cost too much, or because it would have been a bit weird to be providing a 100% subsidy to a private industry?
To my knowledge, I don't know if government's made a decision yet about what they'd like to do. I mean, I know that Albanese has said that universal early childhood education care wants to be his legacy. So what steps are done towards that, I guess we'll see in the coming years. I think in terms of subsidizing for 100%, I think that would definitely help with a lot of affordability. But subsidizing at 100% is only really subsidizing the cap that government sets. And so if a service is, say you're a low income family living in a high income area, if a service is costing $200 a day and the cap is $140 a day, even if you're subsidized 100%, you're still paying $60 a day. And so I think that's why at CPD we've been doing a lot of thinking about different ways of funding rather than just increasing the existing childcare subsidy system, which might further exacerbate the issues that we already have.
So it works a bit like Medicare, doesn't it? You get a certain amount back when you go to the doctor, but if the doctor wants to charge $100 or $120 per visit, then you've got to pay the gap.
Yes, similar to Medicare, but of course, in addition, there's the means testing element as well.
Which, that's right, Medicare is not means tested. So what do you think should happen?
So I was very excited to hear you talk about nationalisation because I think it does go to the heart of the issues that we've just discussed about. And nationalisation is around making education and care a public good and removing the profit motive out of the system. I think if we were designing it from scratch, that could be a really good thing to consider. And I think there's definitely a role for government to come in and provide more services themselves. But there are over 18,000 services currently operating under the childcare subsidy model. So it would involve government needing to come and take over all of them. And we do already have great not-for-profit services. So I think we need a system that incentivizes the really high quality services to expand into the areas that we need, and one that might disincentivize the for-profit services that might be private equity backed and might put profit over quality and care. And so at CPD, what we've been thinking is government can actually change the way that services are funded. So rather than following the user, government can actually directly fund services. And in that way, they can have much more control over where that funding is going and the quality of that funding. They can place conditions, they can place caps on profits, they can make sure that surplus is reinvested into quality and that staff are paid really well. And funding is not the only lever, but it's a really important lever to start really shifting the incentives in the system and supporting the great aspects of it and the great services to operate more.
I never really thought that they would nationalise the industry, and I don't think that, but I did. Yeah. I mean, I was just trying to make a point, really.
Yeah.
I mean, the system that you just described is what Canada now does, isn't it? So how's that going?
There's a lot of similarities between what we've described and what's happening in Canada. Overall, I mean, there's different views about what is happening in Canada. It has made access to early education much more affordable. There has been some criticisms around the quality of services and the inability of supply to expand as demand expands, because as services have become cheaper, more people want to access them, and there hasn't been enough. And so that's why in our proposals, we've really talked about not just funding is really important, but also about government being much more involved in supporting the expansion of supply and supporting high quality. And so that includes things like more involvement in provision planning. It might include things like giving interest-free loans to not-for-profit providers. It might also include opening up services themselves. So it really needs to be a series of different things that government needs to do to achieve what we want to achieve. And we think that funding is a really important part of that.
With private education, that is private schools, primary and secondary, subsidies are only available to schools that are not-for-profit. Do you think that that's possible with childcare and kindergarten, or is it too late for that?
I think it's definitely possible. As I said, 70% of the market right now is for profit. So you could make caps on profits.
Oh, yeah. Rather than say you can't make a profit at all, you could. I mean, are these companies very profitable now? What are their margins like?
So that's another thing. It's really unclear what the margins are like, because it kind of varies service to service, and a lot of the profits might also be a bit hidden, because at the moment it's not just running childcare as a service that might be profitable. It's also the childcare real estate business, and often those who own the childcare centres are different to those who run the childcare service. So there has been some investigation into whether actually the rents are inflated through that, and that might hide where the profits are actually going.
So one of the ways that I guess these centres increase their margins and profits is by not employing enough people and underpaying them, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem when you have for-profit provision, and especially if you have, you know, there's a difference between a for-profit provider that's run by a family that knows the community and there's incentives to keep it high quality, and a for-profit provider that might be private equity backed and there's really strict incentives to increase margins, cut costs at the expense of quality. I mean, that's where the incentives lie.
Adele Ferguson has been doing some great work for the ABC into allegations of child abuse in childcare. You've watched this industry very closely. Were those revelations a surprise to you?
I mean, I think it's obviously so harrowing for any parent to experience that, and I can imagine it's, you know, a lot of parents would have been really frightened to see that come out. I don't know if I was super surprised by it. I mean, I think, like I said, there's a lot of really great high quality provision, but the way that the market is made up and the way that the incentives are at play, you can see how the profit incentive does at times trump the quality and care of children. So I guess it's no surprise that in a system like we have that is so privatized, we do have instances like that.
But what is there data on this? I mean, like the safety of government and not-for-profit versus for-profit, has anyone done work on that?
There's data around the quality of not-for-profit versus for-profit, and we know that for-profits are lower quality standards on average versus not-for-profits. And we also know that for-profits charge on average higher prices at the same time than not-for-profits.
So they're both worse and more expensive, according to the data.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, we haven't published it yet, but we've done a bit of analysis about the relationship between price and quality. And we found that there isn't really a relationship. And in fact, the biggest predictor of whether a service is high quality is the provider management type. So the ownership structure.
Are you aware of what the government is doing? I mean, do we expect that the government's working on some changes?
It's really hard to know. They have made some changes already. So there's the activity test, which I spoke about, the three-day guarantee, and there's been an increase in a 15% increase in remuneration for early childhood educators, and also a fund to build more centres. So there has been some progress. Like I said, I mean, it is something that Albanese has said it's going to be his legacy. So hopeful that there will be more substantive changes that will actually be sustainable and last for a longer period of time. But it's at this point, it's really unclear what those changes will be and how ambitious they'll be.
If there was one thing you could ask them to get them to do, what would it be? Would it be just to copy Canada or what?
I mean, I think it's difficult to one thing. We've been talking a lot about switching the funding system, but I would probably say three things. One would be changing the way that the system's funded. The other one would be supporting workforce, because workforce is so important in delivering quality care, making sure that they're remunerated and supported. And thirdly, being more actively involved and hands-on in how the market is shaped, which could involve supporting not-for-profits or delivering services themselves.
And regulating them more, do you mean?
I think it's less about regulation and giving more, you know, obviously there needs to be some regulation and there needs to be some reporting and things like that, but it's being more proactive about it. It's actually supporting the uplift of quality rather than putting more requirements on providers to report particular things. So there is a bit of regulation in that, but it's also just, yeah, being more involved in supporting better quality service provision. And, you know, I was talking to a friend the other day who absolutely loves her early childhood education service. It's a not-for-profit one. There's a parent committee. Parents are involved, but they constantly have problems with funding, and the early educators go above and beyond. They come in on the weekends and they do fundraisers. And I think that we need a system that supports those services to continue and expand and do better care. And so that's where I see government's role, really.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Adelaide. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Alan.
Thanks so much for joining me on That's Business. You can find That's Business on the Business Daily feed every Friday afternoon. So you don't miss out, make sure you follow ABC Business Daily to find us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're a fan of what we're making, tell a friend about us and where to find us. Carrington Clark and the ABC Business Daily team will be back in the feed on Monday.